Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Boston Girl by Anita Diamond. Read by Linda Lavin.
Nobody told you? Ava, sweetheart, if you ask me to talk about how I got to be the woman I am today, what do you think I'm going to say? I'm flattered you want to interview me. And when did I ever say no to my favorite grandchild? I know I say that to all of my grandchildren, and I mean it every single time. That sounds ridiculous or like I'm losing my marbles, but it's true. When you're a grandmother, you'll understand. Why not? Look at the five of you, a doctor, a social worker, two teachers, and now you. Of course they're going to accept you into that program. Don't be silly. My father's probably rolling over in his grave, but I think it's wonderful. Don't tell the rest of them, but you really are my favorite, and not only because you're the youngest. Did you know you were named after me? It's a good story. Everyone else is named in memory of someone who died, like your sister Jessica, who was named for my nephew Jake, but I was very sick when you were born, and when they thought I wasn't going to make it, they went ahead and just hoped the angel of death wouldn't make a mistake and take you, Ava, instead of me, Addie. Your parents weren't that superstitious, but they had to tell everyone you were named after your father's cousin Arlene, so people wouldn't give them a hard time. It's a lot of names to remember, I know. Grandpa and I named your Aunt Sylvia for your grandfather's mother, who died in the flu epidemic. Your mother is Clara, after my sister Celia. What do you mean you didn't know I had a sister named Celia? That's impossible. Betty was the oldest, then Celia, then me. Maybe you forgot? Nobody told you? You're sure? Well, maybe it's not such a surprise. People don't talk so much about sad memories. And it was a long time ago. But you should know this, so go ahead. Turn on the tape recorder. My father came to Boston from what must be Russia now. He took my sisters, Betty and Celia, with him. It was 1896, maybe 1897, I'm not sure. My mother came 3 or 4 years later, and I was born here in 1900. I've lived in Boston my whole life, which anyone can tell the minute I open my mouth. That's where I started to be my own person. Where I lived in the North End when I was a little girl wasn't so quaint. The neighborhood smelled of garbage and worse. In my building, to go to the bathroom, we had to walk down 3 flights from our apartment to the outhouses and back. Those were disgusting, believe me. But the stairways were what really scared me. At night, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face, and it was slippery from all the dirt and grease. One lady broke a leg on those steps, and she never walked right again afterward. In 1915, there were 4 of us living in one room. We had a stove, a table, a few chairs, and a saggy couch that Mama and Papa slept on at night. Celia and I shared a bed in a kind of narrow hallway that didn't go anywhere. The landlords chopped up those apartments to squeeze in more people so they could get more rent. The only good thing about our place was that we had a window that looked out on the street, so there was a little light. A lot of the apartments faced the air shaft, where it was always the middle of the night. Mama didn't like it when I looked out the window. "What if someone saw you there?" she'd say. "It makes you look like you have nothing better to do." I didn't understand why it bothered her, but I kept my mouth shut so I wouldn't get a smack. We were poor, but not starving. Papa worked in a belt factory as a cutter, and Celia was a finisher at a little shirtwaist factory upstairs over an Italian butcher shop. I don't think we called it a sweatshop back then, but that's what it was. and in the summer it was steaming hot. When my mother wasn't cooking or cleaning, she was mending sheets for the laundry across the street. I think she got a penny apiece. Together, they made enough money for rent and food. Mostly, I remember eating potatoes and cabbage. I still can't stand the smell of cabbage. Sometimes Mama took in a boarder, usually a man right off the boat who needed a place to flop for a few nights. I didn't mind because she didn't yell so much if one of them was in the house, but they made Celia nervous. Celia was delicate. That's what Mama called her. My sister was thin and had high cheekbones, like my father, blue eyes, fine brown hair like him, too. She would have been as pretty as the drawings in the magazines, but she was so shy that she winced when people talked to her, especially the men Mama pushed at her. Celia didn't like to go out of the house. She said it was because her English was bad. Actually, she understood a lot, but she wouldn't talk. My mother was like that, too. Papa managed a little better, but at home, we only spoke Yiddish. When Mama talked about Celia to the neighbors, she said, 29 years old already, like it was a death sentence. But in the next breath, she'd brag, my Celia has such golden hands, she could sew the wings on a bird. And such a good girl, modest, obedient, never gives me any trouble. I was the other one. The other one is almost 15 years old and still in school, selfish and lazy. She pretends like she can't sew. But I wasn't pretending. Every time I picked up a needle, I stabbed myself. One time when Mama gave me a sheet to help with her sewing, I left so many little bloodstains she couldn't wash them out. She had to pay for the sheet, which cost her I don't know how many days of work. I got a good smack for that, I can tell you. You wouldn't know Celia and I were sisters from looking at us. We had the same nose, straight and a little flat, and we were both a little more than 5 feet. But I was built like my mother, solid but not fat, curvy starting at 13. I had Mama's thin wrists and reddish-brown hair, which was so thick it could break the bristles on the brush. I thought I was a real plain Jane, except for my eyes, which are like yours, Ava. Hazel, the little gold circle in the middle. I was only 10 years old when my older sister Betty moved out of the house. I remember I was hiding under the table the day she left. Mama was screaming how girls were supposed to live with their families until they got married, and the only kind of woman who went on her own was a kurva. That's whore in Yiddish. I had to ask a kid at school what it meant. After that, Mama never said Betty's name in public, but at home she talked about her all the time. A real American, she said, making it sound like a curse. But it was true. Betty had learned English fast. She dressed like a modern girl. She wore pointy shoes with heels, and you could see her ankles. She got herself a job selling dresses downtown at Filene's department store, which was unusual for someone who wasn't born in this country. I didn't see her much after she moved out, and I missed her. It was too quiet without Betty in the house. I didn't mind that there was less fighting between her and Mama, but she was the only one who ever got Celia and my father to laugh. Home wasn't so good, but I liked going to school. I liked the way it felt to be in rooms with tall ceilings and big windows. I liked reading and getting A's and being told I was a good student. I used to go to the library every afternoon. After I finished elementary school, one of my teachers came to the apartment to tell Mama and Papa I should go to high school. I still remember his name, Mr. Wallace, and how he said it would be a shame for me to quit and I could get a better job if I kept going. They listened to him, very polite, but when he was finished, Papa said, "She reads and she counts. It's enough." I cried myself to sleep that night, and the next day I stayed really late at the library, even though I knew I'd get in trouble. I didn't even want to look at my parents. I hated them so much. But that night when we were in bed, Celia said not to be sad, that I was going to high school for 1 year at least. She must have talked to Papa. If she said something was making her upset or unhappy, he got worried that she would stop eating which she did sometimes. He couldn't stand that. I was so excited to go to high school. The ceilings were even higher, which made me feel like a giant, like I was important. And mostly I loved it there. My English teacher was an old lady who always wore a lace collar and who gave me A's on my papers, but kept telling me that she expected more out of me. I was almost as good in arithmetic, but the history teacher didn't like me. In front of the whole class, he asked if I had ants in my pants because I raised my hand so much. The other kids laughed, so I stopped asking so many questions, but not completely. After school, I went to the Salem Street Settlement House with a lot of the other girls in my grade. I took a cooking class there once, but mostly I went to the library, where I could finish my schoolwork and read whatever I found on the shelves. And on Thursdays, there was a reading club for girls my age. This is probably where the answer to your question begins. How did I get to be the woman I am today? It started in that library, in the reading club. That's where I started to be my own person. Three cheers for Addie Baum. The Settlement House was a four-story building that stood out from everything else in the neighborhood. It was new with yellow bricks instead of red. It had electricity in all the rooms, so at night it lit up the street like a lantern. It was busy all day. There was a baby nursery for mothers who worked, a wood shop to teach boys a trade, and English classes for immigrants. After dark, women would come in to ask for food and coal so their children wouldn't starve or freeze. The neighborhood was that poor. Miss Edith Chevalier was in charge of all that, and a lot more. She's the one who started the library groups for girls. One for the Irish, one for Italians, and one for Jews. Sometimes she would look in and ask what we were reading, not to test us, but just because she wanted to know. That's what happened on the day my club was reading The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere, out loud. I guess I was better than the others because after the meeting, Miss Chevalier asked if I would recite the whole poem to the Saturday Club. She said a famous professor was going to give a lecture about Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, and she thought a presentation of his most famous poem would be a nice way to start the evening. She said that I would have to memorize it. But that shouldn't be a problem for a girl of your ability. I'm telling you, my feet didn't touch the ground all the way home. It was the biggest thing that ever happened to me, and I learned the whole poem by heart in 2 days so I'd be ready for our first rehearsal. Miss Chevalier was a small woman, few inches shorter than me, which meant less than 5 feet. She had a moon face and chubby fingers and coppery hair that sprang straight up from her head, which is why some of the girls called her the poodle. But she had one of those smiles that makes you feel like you just did something right, which was a good thing since I was a nervous wreck when I went to her office to practice. I only got halfway through the poem when Miss Chevalier stopped me and asked me if I knew what impetuous meant. She was nice about it, but I wanted to sink through the floor because not only did I not know what the word meant, I had mispronounced it. I'm sure I turned bright red, but Miss Chevalier pretended not to notice and handed me the dictionary and said to read the definition out loud. I will never forget. Impetuous means two things: rushing with great force or violence, and acting suddenly with little thought. She asked me which one I thought Mr. Longfellow meant. I reread those definitions over and over, trying to figure out the right answer, but Miss Chevalier must have read my mind. There is no wrong answer, she said. I want to know your opinion, Addie. What do you think? I had never been asked for my opinion, but I knew I couldn't keep her waiting, so I said the first thing that came into my head, which was, maybe he meant both. She liked that. The Patriots had to be impetuous both ways, or they wouldn't have dared challenge the British. Then she asked, would you call yourself impetuous, Addie? That time I knew she was asking for an opinion. My mother thinks I am. She said mothers were right to be concerned for their daughter's welfare. But I believe that girls need gumption, too. Especially in this day and age, I believe you are a girl with gumption. After I looked up gumption, I never let anyone call Miss Chevalier the poodle again. I told Celia and my parents about the big honor of reciting for the Saturday Club, but when the day came and I put on my coat, Mama said, "You're not going anywhere." I told her they were waiting for me and that I had practiced and they couldn't start without me, but she shrugged like it was nothing. "It's too cold. Let someone else get pneumonia." I couldn't believe what she was saying. I argued and begged, and finally I was yelling, "No one else can do it. They're counting on me. If I don't go, I won't be able to show my face there again." Mama said, "When I was your age, I didn't step a foot outside without my mother, so close your mouth before I get mad." Celia said, "Let her go, Mama. It's not far. She can wear my scarf." My mother almost never snapped at Celia, but she said, "Stay out of this. That one sits in that school while you're killing yourself at work. She's already ruining her eyes from reading. No man wants to marry a girl with a squint." "Maybe I don't want to get married." The moment I said that, I ran behind where Celia was sitting so Mama couldn't slap me, but she just laughed. "Are you so stupid? Marriage and children are a woman's crown." I said, "Like for Mrs. Freistad?" Mama didn't have an answer for Mrs. Freistad. She lived across the street. One day her husband came home from work and said he couldn't live with a woman he didn't love, so after 20 years and 4 little girls, he walked out just like that. The wife didn't speak English and she didn't know how to do anything but clean and cook. They got so poor, she and the daughters. Everyone in the neighborhood was ashamed for them. Talking about Mrs. Freistad was the last straw for Mama, and she came at me with both hands, slapping and cursing, and saying things like, "Ungrateful worm, monster, a plague you are." I was jumping around to keep away from her, which made her even madder. "My father would have taken a strap to you," she yelled, and finally got me on the cheek with a loud slap that made Celia wail as if Mama had hit her instead of me. My mother had me against the wall, holding my wrists, and I was hollering, "Leave me alone," when Papa walked in and told her to let me go. Mama screamed, "You don't do anything, and I'm not having another whore in this family." "Don't use that word," he yelled. "Betty is a good girl." Someone started pounding on the door. "Shut up in there." Celia had been crying the whole time, but now she started banging her forehead on the table. She was saying, "Stop, stop, stop," and hitting her head hard enough that we could hear the sound of her face on the wood. Papa grabbed her by the shoulders. "Lena, she's hurting herself." Mama let go of me to look, and I ran. The cold wind on my face felt like it was washing away everything that happened upstairs. I walked fast and whispered the poem to myself in time with my feet. "Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. On the 18th of April in 75, hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year." I was almost calm when I got to the settlement house, but it was a big shock to see all the chairs and benches in the big meeting room full of girls talking and laughing with each other. The Saturday Club was different from all the other clubs. It was bigger. 50 girls instead of 10 or 12, and all the religions were together. They were older, too. Some were in high school, but a lot of them had jobs. They also held elections and ran their own meetings. I was only 3 or 4 years younger than most of them, but to me, they were practically grown-ups. Miss Chevalier was at the door and sent me to sit in the front row while she waited for the professor. She said he should be there any moment, but 5 minutes passed, and another 5, and another, and I was getting more and more nervous. My hands were shaking when he finally got there. He looked so much like the pictures of Longfellow with the white beard and long hair. It was as if he'd come back from the dead. Rose Reardon, the club president, banged a gavel, made some announcements. I didn't hear a word, and Miss Chevalier had to tap me on the shoulder when it was time for me to go up to the platform. My knees were like rubber. I had a lot to remember, and not just the words. Miss Chevalier had given me a lot of directions to add to the drama. This was the north end of Boston, where every schoolchild knew the midnight ride, and we were all pretty sick of it. Miss Chevalier gave me a big smile and a nod to start me off. I remembered to begin as if I were a little out of breath, like I had a surprise to tell. Then I tried to make Paul Revere seem like a real person, tapping my foot to make it look like he was impatient to get going. I whispered about the graves being lonely and spectral and somber and still, making it sound spooky. At the end, I went very, very slow. In the hour of darkness and peril and need, the people will waken and listen to hear the hurrying hoofbeats of that steed and the midnight message of Paul Revere. I counted to three and bowed my head like Miss Chevalier showed me. There was a big round of applause and even a three cheers for Addie Baum. Miss Chevalier put her arm around me and introduced me to the professor, who said I'd done the great man proud. Then he gave his talk, and boy did he talk. It was not only long, but it was also so boring it was like listening to a clock tick. Girls started yawning and looking at their fingernails, and even Miss Chevalier had to pretend she was paying attention. When he stopped to blow his nose, she stood up and clapped as if he were finished. Everyone else clapped too, but I think it was to thank Miss Chevalier for rescuing us. After the lecture, I was the belle of the ball. Girls I didn't know came over to say what a good job I'd done and ask where I worked and did I want another cup of punch or a cookie. Miss Chevalier introduced me to Miss Green, the artist who ran a pottery studio in the settlement house. The two of them lived in an apartment on the top floor. They had the same first name, so everyone called them the Ediths. They were about the same height, but Miss Green looked like a sparrow compared to Miss Chevalier, who was more of a pigeon. Miss Green tilted her head the way a bird would and looked me over with round, bright bird eyes. "Miss Chevalier has told me so much about you," she said. "I hope she's talked to you about going to Rockport Lodge this summer. It's just the thing for a girl like you." Miss Chevalier explained that Rockport Lodge was an inn for young ladies in a seaside town north of Boston. She said it wasn't expensive, and some members of the Saturday Club went regularly. Miss Green said, "You must know that the Fromer girls have been there a few times." I guess she thought that all Jewish girls knew each other, but I only met Helen and Gussie Fromer that night. Helen was the older one, a real peaches and cream beauty. That could have been hard for Gussie, who had a big nose and a mousy complexion, but you never saw two sisters who looked out for each other like those two. Helen was sweet, but Gussie had the big personality. She walked me around the room and introduced me to just about everyone. When we got to Rose Reardon, she said, "Madam President, don't you think Addie should join the Saturday Club? Miss Chevalier brought her, so you know she'll be all for it." Rose said, "Of course you should join." She was a healthy girl with auburn hair and pretty green eyes and a gap between her two front teeth. People used to call her kind of a face a map of Ireland. "You should come to Rockport Lodge, too," she said. "In the evenings, we do skits and sing songs, and some of the girls read poems right up your alley. And we don't go hungry." She patted her stomach. "Three meals a day and cake at supper." I was having such a good time. It was hard to think about going home, and I was one of the last ones to leave. I walked outside with Philomena Gallinelli, who said she couldn't imagine standing in front of so many people the way I did. "You looked like you were enjoying it."
"I was terrified," I said.
"Then you must be a great actress." I had seen Philomena around the settlement house and thought she was gorgeous. Dark eyes, dark hair, olive skin, a real Italian. She wore her hair in a long braid over her shoulder, which was completely out of fashion, but she could get away with it, not only because it looked good on her, but also because she was an artist. Philomena was one of the few girls who had full-time jobs in the Salem Street Pottery Studio. She was Miss Green's favorite, and nobody minded because she was so talented. She asked if my name was really Adeline because of Sweet Adeline, the song. I told her no, just Addie. It was my sister Betty's idea, and my father liked it because it sounded like his grandmother Altie. She said she envied me for having an American name. Philomena is too long and no one can pronounce it. I said, but your name fits you. It's beautiful and unusual. Addie's just plain and ordinary. What are you talking about, she said. You've got a nice shape and beautiful eyes. No one who's ordinary can recite like you did tonight. After we said goodnight, I was too keyed up to go home, so I kept walking and walking up and down Hanover Street, looping around the high school, making a big circle around my block. The cold didn't bother me because my mind was going a million miles an hour. I wondered what Miss Green meant when she said, a girl like you, and if I could be friends with Gussie, Helen, and Rose. I remember the applause and every compliment and how friendly Philomena had been. See you next week, she said. It had been the best night of my life, and if I hadn't walked into a puddle and soaked my shoes, I would have walked all the way to Rockport Lodge, wherever that was. What are friends for? I'll never forget when I took your mother to see The Wizard of Oz. You know the scene when everything changes from black and white to color? That's what it felt like the first time I went to Rockport. Everything was in color. Everything was new. Even things I'd seen my whole life. The ocean, for example. Boston Harbor was a few blocks from where I grew up, and sure, the water there was filthy, and the docks were smelly and dangerous. But how could I not know about low tide and high tide? I had never seen a cloud change the color of the sea in a second, or heard water crashing so loud you couldn't hear the person standing right next to you. The first week I was at Rockport Lodge, I saw corn growing out of the ground, and goats and lighthouses. When I closed my eyes at night, I could still see fireflies blinking. I couldn't get over those fireflies. It was the first time I ever slept in a bed by myself. And the sheets? Ironed. It felt like sleeping on silk. I got my own towel and a pillow that smelled like flowers. So many new smells. Beach roses, seaweed, smoke from a bonfire. I ate hot dogs and cherry pie and saltwater taffy that got stuck in my teeth. It didn't cost a lot to go to Rockport Lodge in 1916. I think it was $7 for a week, which was $7 more than I ever had. When Miss Chevalier found out that I couldn't afford to go, she gave me a job as her assistant. Actually, she made a job out of thin air. I took her letters to the mailbox, I helped in the baby nursery when one of the regular attendants was sick, and I put away books in the library. I swept up in the pottery studio, too, where I got to watch Philomena and the other girls paint Miss Green's designs on the plates and vases they sold in a little gift shop they ran on the ground floor. When Miss Chevalier ran out of things for me to do, she had me sit in her office and read books by Charles Dickens for us to talk about. I got very friendly with her dictionary. She paid me 50 cents a week, but I was getting so much more than that. I had a private class in literature, the chance to watch artists' work, and time to read. I didn't appreciate it at the time, but what did I know? I was 16 years old. I didn't say a word to anyone at home about what I was doing. I would have told Celia, but my sister could never keep a secret or tell a lie. My parents didn't know what a vacation was, and what was I going to say? That I was earning money so I could go away and do nothing? That I had money but wasn't helping to pay the bills when Celia handed over every penny? I did feel guilty about that. I tried to make up for it by eating less. I'm sure nobody noticed. The day I went to Rockport was my 16th birthday, July 10th. I didn't have to do a lot to get ready. I could wear just about all the clothes I owned, and the rest I stuffed into an old pillowcase I bought from a ragman's cart for a few pennies. I left a note in Celia's shoe to say I was going on a vacation with some nice girls I knew. I also left $2, all of my spending money, even though I knew it wouldn't make any difference to my mother. I put chicken fat on the door hinges so they wouldn't squeak in the morning. I was very proud of myself for thinking of that. I didn't close my eyes at all the night before I left. I was out of bed the second it started to get light, and I held my breath until I got to the stoop and stopped to put on my shoes. It was strange to be outside so early. The streets were completely empty and quiet. Not even the milkman was there, no one. It was spooky. Without the people, I could see how dirty it was. There was garbage piled up all over the place, and I saw rats running in and out. In the gutters, there was all kinds of filth, the worst you can imagine. I ran as fast as I could to get out of there and down to the harbor where Gussie and Helen and Rose were waiting. Most of the girls were taking the train to Rockport, but Miss Chevalier had gotten boat tickets for us. It was a gorgeous day. The sea was calm and the sun was warm, and I stayed at the front railing for the whole trip. I didn't want to miss anything. I wish I'd been keeping a diary, but I still remember how the water was slapping against the hull of the ship, and that to me it sounded like clapping. A seagull flew down and hung in the air maybe 10 feet from my shoulder, and I could see all the little markings on his wings and how his eye looked like a gray marble rolling around in his head. By the time we got to Gloucester, my face hurt from smiling. When we got close to the dock, Rose started jumping up and down and waving at a heavy-set woman in a big feathered hat. "I can't believe they sent Mrs. Morse to get us," she said. "She is the best cook in the world." Mrs. Morse didn't seem so excited to see us. She hurried us into a real old-fashioned horse-drawn cart, and we had to sit on the floor between sacks of flour with our feet hanging off the back. It's good that we were wedged in so tight, because whenever we hit a bump in the road, everyone flew up in the air, like in a roller coaster. It was kind of fun, but my behind was plenty sore by the time we stopped. Rockport Lodge was more beautiful than I had imagined. A big, white-painted farmhouse with black shutters, two stories, and porches on each side of the front door. Vines with button-sized red roses climbed through the railings, almost up to the upstairs windows, where white curtains puffed in and out. Next to the house, there was an orchard with benches in the shade. Philomena met us at the door and said that she had asked to have me as her roommate. "I hope that's okay with you." I couldn't believe it. Since we met at Saturday Club, we had only said a few words to each other in the pottery studio. I was a little bit in awe of her, not just for her looks and her talent, but also for her self-confidence. Philomena was the only girl in the studio that Miss Green trusted to decorate the really big vases, the ones that went to art shows and sold for a lot of money. I know some of the other girls would have liked the chance to do that, but she didn't apologize for being chosen. I don't mean that she bragged. Philomena just knew who she was, which wasn't so easy back then. I guess it's still not easy, is it? It took me until I was in my 40s before I knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. I followed her up the front stairs to a long hallway where all the doors were open and I could see girls unpacking and changing clothes, talking and laughing like it was a party. Our room was at the very end. It's small, but there's only two of us. Some of the others have four girls crammed in. The room was just big enough for two narrow beds, a bureau, and one wooden chair. It was all very plain, white walls and a worn wooden floor, but the light from the window bounced off the walls and made the white bedspreads seem to glow. Philomena stretched out on one of the cots, but I didn't want to wrinkle anything, so I stayed by the door. When you bring up your valise, you can put your things in the bottom drawers. When Philomena said valise, I dropped my lumpy pillowcase and thought, oh no, what am I doing here? But she caught on right away. Aren't you smart to pack light? I always bring too many clothes, and part of the fun is sharing. That was so nice of her. I could have cried with relief. But thankfully, someone rang a bell downstairs. That's lunch, Philomena said. They're always telling you how fresh air works up an appetite, and they must be right, because I'm always starving when I'm here. In the dining room, there were 6 big oak tables, all set with plates, glasses, silverware, and white cloth napkins, which I'd only ever seen in movies. Philomena pointed me to where Rose was sitting with Helen and Gussie Frommer. See you later, she said, and went to a table full of dark-haired girls who could have been her cousins. Rose was sitting next to a pale, skinny girl with green eyes, carrot-colored hair, and a million freckles. Rose said, this is my roommate, Irene Conley. She's from Boston, too. I said hello, but Irene shrugged and looked right past me. Rose, who always had a smile on her face, glared at her. Do you have a toothache or something? Irene shrugged again and crossed her arms. Helen asked if I was settled in my room and did I need anything. She was like a mother hen, as nice as she was pretty, and that day she was wearing a pink shirtwaist that made her look like a flower. But when I started to say how good she looked, she stopped me. Has my sister introduced you to everybody? Gussie is the mayor of Rockport Lodge. Gussie was plain as a brick, but people liked her because she made them feel important. Whenever she met someone new, she wanted to know everything about them. Helen teased Gussie about her cross-examinations, but it was flattering to be asked to talk about yourself. At my second Saturday Club meeting, Gussie got me in a corner and asked me about school, my favorite movie stars, my family, and what I thought about the temperance movement. When I said I didn't understand it very well, she explained how it was a good idea that couldn't work. Gussie never forgot a name or anything you told her. She would have made a great politician. When she noticed me looking over at Philomena's table, she said, they've been friends forever. The Italians stick together, like everyone. The girls behind us all come from one club in Arlington. The table next to them is 100% Irish. Sometimes there's a Jewish bunch, but our table is like the Saturday Club, all mixed together. I said, like mixed nuts. Rose laughed. I love that. We should call ourselves the mixed nuts. Crazy enough to talk to anyone who talks to us. Gussie made a toast with her water glass. To the mixed nuts. Before lunch, we met the women who were in charge of Rockport Lodge that year. Miss Holbrook and Miss Case reminded me a little of Miss Chevalier and Miss Green. They were much younger and didn't look anything like the Ediths, but they were smart and wore sensible shoes and no lipstick. Miss Holbrook had on a pair of navy blue bloomers that were so out of date it looked like she was wearing a costume. She had big gray teeth and a long mane of coarse, sandy-colored hair that made her look like a horse, and she wore a whistle around her neck on a string that hung straight down her chest. She was in charge of all the outside activities, lawn tennis, archery, croquet, visits to town, and other attractions, as she called it, and bicycling. Miss Case was so blonde that her eyebrows and eyelashes were practically invisible. She was smaller and quieter than Miss Holbrook, but she was the boss. I remember she carried around a ledger book and held it out flat in front of her, like it was a desk. Miss Case said that we would say grace before eating. Rose and Irene bowed their heads and folded their hands, but Gussie, Helen, and I sort of froze. Miss Case closed her eyes and thanked God for the food, for the people who gave money so we could enjoy the blessings of God's green earth, for good health and the United States, and that we owed it all to Jesus Christ. I asked Gussie if they always did that. They always pray, she said, but I never heard anyone say that last part. Jews never said Jesus or Christ out loud. We weren't supposed to go inside a church either, like it was a contagious disease. I actually didn't think much about being Jewish as a kid. In my neighborhood, there were Jews and Italians and Irish, and everyone got along pretty well. Sometimes the boys got into fights, and some of it had to do with religion, but it was pretty much live and let live, as I remember it. I got a little self-conscious when I saw Helen and Gussie take the ham out of their sandwiches and eat just bread with mustard. But I was hungry, and I ate the meat, and it wasn't the first time. I was hungry a lot when I was young, and I never turned down food, including things I knew were not kosher. Nothing bad ever happened to me, and a lot of it was delicious, so I ate everything they put in front of me at Rockport Lodge. Except for the pickles. Who ever heard of a pickle that was sweet or soft? Feh. After lunch, they sent everyone upstairs to put on shoes and hats to get ready for a hike. I didn't have a dictionary, so I asked Rose what a hike was. She said hiking is the same thing as walking, only hotter and twice as far as you want to go, but usually you're glad you went. I didn't have a hat or another pair of shoes, so I just went to wait on the porch. The only chairs out there were made out of wooden twigs woven together. I couldn't believe something like that could be comfortable, which shows you what a greenhorn I was, all excited about a wicker chair. Rockport Lodge was on the road between Gloucester and Rockport, but I only saw one car pass by. It was so quiet that I could hear the bees buzzing around the roses and a bird singing from far away. Someone upstairs called, "Has anyone seen my hairbrush?" In the kitchen, there was chopping. Every sound was separate, like framed pictures on a wall. I thought, aha, this is what you call peace and quiet. Rose came outside wearing an old straw hat and canvas shoes. Irene was with her, but it was obvious that she didn't want to be there. Rose told me I promised if she came with me this one time, I wouldn't bother her again. Miss Holbrook brought a stack of newspapers and started folding them into three-cornered hats. She tried one on, and some of the girls giggled. "I know it's not a la mode, but I will not have any of you fainting from heat stroke on your first day." It turned out that the only girls without hats were Irene and me. She got stuck in one with advertisements for ladies' corsets on all three sides. I was lucky. I only got the baseball scores. Miss Holbrook blew her whistle and said, "Away we go!" She had a loud, high voice that carried just as far as that whistle. There were about 20 of us girls. We followed her through the orchard next to the lodge and onto a dirt road with fields planted in long rows on each side. Miss Holbrook told us which were squash plants and which were corn, but she was even more interested in the stone walls. She called them relics. "An American Stonehenge, if you will." I looked it up later. At the end of the road, we found ourselves right on the coast, looking straight out to sea. The sun was so bright on the water, it was like staring at a million tiny mirrors. I heard Irene whisper, "Holy mackerel." I whispered back, "Amen." She smiled in spite of herself, and you never saw a cuter pair of dimples. Miss Holbrook led us past a row of mansions, most of them with two or three balconies that faced the ocean. One of them had a fairy tale turret. Rose sighed, "You'd never get me off that porch." We took a path around the back of Rockport and up a hill to Dogtown, which is a big woods right in the middle of Cape Ann, where Miss Holbrook said she had something very special to show us. The farther we got from the water, the hotter it was. I was wearing a long-sleeved shirtwaist and my shoes were pinching, so I hoped her special treat involved ice cream or lemonade. It was cooler when we got to the forest, and Miss Holbrook said, "We'll be there soon, girls." We started walking faster, and everyone tried to guess what wonder we were going to see. A waterfall, blueberries. But when she stopped and said, "Here we are," I didn't see anything special, just trees and shrubs and rocks. "Where are we?" said Gussie. Miss Holbrook walked over to a huge boulder and patted it as if it were a puppy. "We have reached our first erratic and one of my favorite specimens. Isn't it a beauty?" Nobody said a word until Irene muttered, "We came all this way to look at a stupid rock." I was sweaty and thirsty. My legs ached. I had blisters on both feet, and I thought that was the funniest thing I'd ever heard. Miss Holbrook spun around and gave me the fisheye, but I couldn't stop laughing. I covered my mouth and turned around, but by then Rose was laughing, and she had one of those big belly laughs that got everyone else going. Miss Holbrook was furious. Then she was offended, and then hurt. "I suppose not everyone has a taste for geology," she said. "Thank goodness she's not the cook," Irene said, and I cracked up all over again. Irene didn't come to supper that night. Rose said she'd gotten a bad sunburn. But it's her own fault for throwing away the hat. I'm washing my hands of that girl. I said, "She's not so bad, but it makes you wonder why she's here at all." Rose had found out that much. Her brother had sent her and paid her way. I told Irene that makes him a saint in my book, and she gave me a look that would have boiled an egg. After supper, Miss Case opened her ledger to tell us about the schedule for the week, and it all sounded wonderful. There was going to be a breakfast cookout, a trip to Good Harbor Beach, blueberry picking, shopping in Rockport and Gloucester. We were going to a town dance, too, which got everyone whispering and giggling. That's when I noticed Irene peeking in from the hallway. She had a cloth pressed against her forehead, and I went out and asked her if she was okay. She said she was fine. If Mrs. Morse hadn't sent into town for ice, I think my nose would have peeled off. "It looks like it hurts," I said. Irene shrugged, but then she hid her face in the towel and started to cry. I sat down with her on the steps, and she told me the story of how she had come to America with her older brother 5 years ago, and the two of them had taken care of each other. But he'd gotten married, and his new wife, the cow, Kathleen, wanted Irene out of their apartment right away. Without a word to Irene, the wife got her a job as a live-in maid in Worcester. "Do you have any idea how far that is from Boston?" Irene said. "The brother wouldn't stand up against his bride, so he sent Irene to Rockport as a kind of peace offering. Irene called it the old heave-ho. I was in service once and never again. The lady of the house thinks she owns you and calls you a thief if you eat the crust she leaves on her plate. But it's her who steals your days off. I'd sooner walk the streets." I said there had to be something we could do to help. She shook her head and said, "You're a good kid." And then she went upstairs alone. I walked straight over to Rose and told her what was what with Irene. She called the brother a no-good bum and a few other things and said, "I feel terrible about what I said about that poor girl." She went upstairs and told Irene that she would be staying with her until she got on her feet. No arguments and no thanks needed. "What are friends for?" Rose said. And just like that, the chip on Irene's shoulder disappeared. Her dimples became the envy of everyone, and her impersonation of Miss Holbrook had us rolling on the floor. "Allow me to serve you a taste of scenery," Irene said, in Miss Holbrook's voice, which was sing-song and fruity, sort of like Julia Child's, come to think of it. "Now, who wants a piping hot slab of granite?" It still makes me laugh. You have a good eye. The best part of that week was my time with Philomena. We stayed up late every night talking. She seemed so grown up, I couldn't believe that she was only 19, just 3 years older than me. We started with our families, and I still remember all of her sisters' names. Maria Immaculata, Maria Teresa, Maria Domenica, Maria Sophia, and she was Maria Filomena, the youngest and also the only unmarried one. Her parents died when she was a baby, so Mimi Immaculata raised her. The whole family lived within a few blocks of each other in the North End, and when I met Filomena, she was staying with Sophie, Maria Sophia, and sharing the couch with two of her three boys. Filomena said she looked forward to coming to Rockport Lodge just so she could sleep without a squirming child waking her up. Filomena left school when she was 12 and went to work sewing in a factory. A few years later, she started going to the Salem Street Settlement House on Saturdays. "I told Mimi that I wanted to improve my English," she said, "but really it was just to have a little time when I wasn't at work or taking care of someone's baby." Miss Chevalier noticed her sketching in the library when she was supposed to be studying. But instead of yelling at me, she took me to meet Miss Green. And here I am. Not so different from my story, right? Miss Green sent her to the museum school for a drawing class. "I owe her everything," Filomena said. "She taught me pottery and design and gives me art books to look at. She says that being an artist is more than a job or a skill. It's a way of walking through the world." I didn't understand what that meant until a few days later when we went to the headlands, which Miss Holbrook said was the most beautiful view on Cape Ann. Irene rolled her eyes. "Stone soup, anyone?" But Miss Holbrook was right about the headlands. It's a special place, up high, maybe 100 feet above the sea, with water on three sides. "You know where I'm talking about, right, Ava? It's the place I always bring people who've never been up to Cape Ann. You can see for miles up and down the coast. It's got a nice view of the boats in Rockport Harbor and most of the town, too. The first time I saw all those white clapboard houses and the church steeple, I thought about how much I owed to Paul Revere for getting me there." Miss Holbrook called it picturesque, and I knew exactly what she meant without having to look it up. "It was like one of those tinted picture postcards. A perfect blue sky and fluffy white clouds, sailboats, and even a few ladies with parasols. The lodge girls scattered around to pick flowers or sit on the rocks and talk. Rose and Irene climbed halfway down the bluff, which almost gave Miss Holbrook a heart attack. Filomena went off by herself to draw, but I tiptoed over to peek at her sketch pad. She was drawing the pile of rocks in front of her, which seemed like a dull subject, but when I looked again, I saw she had made the same shapes into a woman's body, lying on her side, completely naked. I'd probably never seen a nude picture before. I must have gasped. Filomena turned around and held it up so I had a better view. "What do you think?" Before I could answer, Miss Holbrook came running toward us, yoo-hooing for Filomena to come with her. Two ladies had set up easels to do watercolors of the harbor. "You should meet them. They are painting the most charming little harbor scenes." Filomena wrinkled her nose. "Miss Green says charming is a trap that women artists should avoid at all costs." Miss Holbrook said, "These ladies are very accomplished, I assure you." Filomena stared her in the eye and said, "Miss Edith Green is an instructor at the School of the Museum of Fine Arts, and she is the one who told me to focus all my attention on drawing this week. I'm sure you agree I should take her assignment seriously." Miss Holbrook couldn't say no to that. Walked away with her tail between her legs. "Did Miss Green really say that?" I asked. Filomena laughed. "She could have. Edith Green thinks everything rests on drawing. You can see it in the designs on the pottery." "I like the way you do the trees," I said. "It's just a few lines, but they seem alive." That's exactly right, Philomena said. You have a good eye. That was a compliment I never forgot, obviously. Toward the end of the week, Philomena switched tables and joined the mixed nuts. Gussie teased her and asked if she'd gotten kicked out of the Italian club for hanging around so much with the Jews and the Irish. I just need to talk about something besides weddings, Philomena said. They're getting married this year, all of them. Helen said, your time will come. Not me, said Philomena. I'm never getting married. Rose said she was too pretty to be an old maid. Gussie didn't like that. Philomena may want to do other things with her life. For example, I am going to college. And after that, she's going to law school, said Helen. But don't you want a family, Rose asked. Gussie said, Helen's going to have children. I'll borrow hers. Helen blushed, and Irene said, looks like she already knows who the father's going to be. Don't embarrass her, said Rose. Besides, she'd tell us if there was someone, wouldn't you, Helen? My sister can have her pick, said Gussie. What about you, Rose? Irene? Any prospects? Addie? Addie's too young to think about that, Philomena said. I was too young, but it was impossible not to think about marriage. Mama talked about Celia's prospects all the time, and at every Saturday club meeting there was talk about weddings the girls had been to or weddings they were going to. Even the Ediths, when they heard about an engagement, acted like it was some kind of victory, and they were all for women's rights and education. I wasn't so sure about marriage. I knew my parents were miserable. And from what I heard in the air shaft, other married people said horrible things to each other all the time. On the other hand, who wouldn't want to be in love and have a man look at me the way Owen Moore looked at Mary Pickford? I used to leave those movies feeling sad that nothing like that would ever happen to me, but I always went back for another happy ending. In the magazine stories, I could imagine myself as one of the smart, spunky girls chased by men who loved them for their brains and gumption. Those girls were airplane daredevils or race car drivers or even doctors, but in the end, they gave it up for love and marriage. When I asked Philomena what she would do if she fell in love, she shrugged. I know that being a wife would mean giving up art, which is what makes me happy. When I say I don't want to get married, my sisters tell me I'm being selfish. And maybe I am. Or maybe there's something wrong with me. I said I didn't think there was anything wrong with her. I wish my sisters were more like you, Addie, she said. Betty and Celia are lucky to have such a good listener in the family. Actually, my sisters and I didn't talk much. They were so much older than me, for one thing. Celia was so quiet. And as for Betty, I saw her once in a blue moon, and only when she was sure Mama would be out of the house and she could sneak in and visit. Even then, she mostly talked to Celia and Papa. Like nothing I could actually touch. I didn't know my father very well. It wasn't like today when fathers change diapers and read books to their children. When I was growing up, men worked all day. When they came home, we were supposed to be quiet and leave them alone. Papa was a good-looking man. He had a long, thin face with light blue eyes and brown hair like Celia's. He was particular about his clothes. They should be clean and neat. Whenever he saw a Jewish man in the street dressed sloppy, he'd say, "They'll think we're all peasants." What I knew about him mostly came from Betty. He grew up in a little shtetl that was hardly even a town, just a place with an inn, a synagogue, and a market once a week where people bought and sold everything. Papa's family had cows, so they weren't the poorest, but they didn't have enough money to send him or his brothers to school. Instead, they learned with their father, my grandfather, who'd studied at some big yeshiva as a boy. I remember Papa had a very old prayer book. Maybe it was from his family. When Papa was 18 or 19, there was a cholera epidemic that killed his father and brothers, so he was in charge of his mother and two sisters. He sold the cows so the girls could get married, and then his mother matched him up with Mama, who was from a poor family but managed to get her a horse for a dowry, which meant Papa could make a living moving and hauling things around. Betty and Celia were born over there, though they were called Bronya and Seema then. My mother was pregnant with a third baby when someone accused my father of stealing a silver cup from the church. In those days, that was the same as a death sentence for a Jew. So he came to America with the two girls. They were maybe 10 and 12 years old, but they went to work with him so he could keep an eye on them. When Papa got a letter that said Mama had had a baby boy, he left them alone at nights and took another job to get the money for her ticket faster. When Mama came, she got off the ship alone. Nahum, she had named the baby for Papa's father, had died on the trip over. They had thrown his body into the sea. All around them, people were smiling and happy to be in America, but she was sobbing and Papa was tearing his clothes. Betty and Celia were there, too. What an awful memory that must have been. Mama had another boy in America, but he died when he was 3 days old, and I never knew his name, if they even gave him one. After I was born, there were no more babies. My mother thought coming to America was a terrible mistake, and she never let Papa forget it. "We should have stayed where we were," she said. "Your son wouldn't have died on that miserable boat. Our daughters would be married, and I'd have grandchildren on my lap." Usually my father didn't answer, but sometimes he got fed up. "You would have been better off if they'd killed me," he said. And then he would leave the house, go to his little shul a few blocks away where nobody yelled at him. He was home in the evening, gone in the morning like a shadow, like nothing I could actually touch. "You must be the smart one." I threw up on the boat all the way back to Boston from the lodge, but it wasn't from seasickness. All week I hadn't let myself think about what was going to happen when I got home. But at that point I couldn't think of anything else, and that's what made me sick to my stomach. What if Mama wouldn't let me back in the house? None of my friends had a place for me. I had no idea where Betty was living, and I was not going to ask Miss Chevalier, not after all she'd already done for me. My only hope was that Celia would stick up for me and get my father on her side, and that would mean a huge screaming fight at the least. Walking up the stairs to our apartment, I felt like a criminal going to be hanged. But when I got to the door, I heard teaspoons clinking in glasses. That could only mean there was sugar on the table, which meant there was company, which almost never happened. When I looked through the keyhole, all I could see was a man's back and my father rubbing his chin, which meant he was either uncomfortable or mad. Mama was pouring tea and smiling her company smile, but she must have noticed the door rattle or something because before I knew it, she was in the hall, pinching me by the ear and talking so fast I could hardly understand her. "You listen to me. You're going to say you were staying in Cambridge to help out a woman who had a baby. Your sister is getting married, thank God, and he doesn't need to know about you." "Betty is getting married," I said. "Don't you dare say that name to Mr. Levine. Celia is the one getting married." I couldn't believe it. I never heard Celia say a word about her boss, good or bad. I said, "But Mr. Levine is too old." 40 is not so old. His wife is dead a year, and he has two little boys without a mother. He sees what a hard worker your sister is, so clean, so nice and quiet. He's got a good business, so she won't want for nothing. Today he brought over coffee and a bottle of whiskey for your father, so you say Mazel Tov and not another word." When Celia saw me, she jumped out of her chair and ran to give me a hug. She was wearing maybe the first new dress I'd ever seen her in, with flowers that brought out her blue eyes. She looked beautiful. Mr. Levine stood up. "Nice to make your acquaintance, Miss Addie. Celia says such nice things about you." He was a small man, maybe an inch taller than I, with a narrow face, and a reddish-brown goatee that made him look like a fox. He said, "Aren't I lucky to marry into a family of such pretty girls? It will be nice for Myron and Jacob to have a sister, too." I said I would be their aunt, not their sister. He laughed and said, "You must be the smart one." Celia took my hand and said I got all A's in school. So Mama had to say that she was sure Mr. Levine's sons were even smarter. "You have to start calling me Herman," he said. "What's your real name?" Papa asked. "I need it for the ketubah, the marriage contract." Levine waved away the question like he was brushing away a fly. "Hirsch, I suppose." Papa made a sour face. This was the kind of man my father called a ganze ganef, a real thief. Levine reached for the whiskey bottle and said, "Let's make a toast to August 15th. "I still don't know what's the hurry," Papa said. "What should they wait for?" said Mama. "They aren't youngsters." My mother and Levine started talking about the wedding. The ceremony was going to be in Papa's little shul around the corner. Levine said he'd pay for honey cake and wine.
"But I will buy the herring," Papa said. "You can't have a wedding without herring."
Levine smiled in the snobbish way Miss Holbrook did when one of the Italian girls had said her mother's cooking was better than the food at the lodge. Levine said he was thinking about joining Temple Israel, and Papa gave him the same look back.
"You mean the big German synagogue where they throw you out if you wear a yarmulke?"
"The rabbi there is very smart," Levine said. "I can make good connections for business, and my sons will meet a better class of people." He winked at me, "and Addie will like it because the women sit with the men, like human beings."
"If you want a church, go to a church," Papa said, and the words hung in the air like a bad smell.
My mother got nervous and said that maybe the bride and groom would like to go for a walk together. Celia said, "And Addie can come with us." See how she looked out for me? I walked a few steps behind them and watched. Celia looked comfortable holding his arm, and he patted her hand a lot, but they didn't say much to each other, and I couldn't tell if there was any feeling between them. We were on Hanover Street, which felt like a carnival after Rockport. There were a lot of people walking and talking at the top of their lungs, in three or four languages, mind you. We walked past a shop window where a group of girls were watching a man take the clothes off a dress dummy. One of the girls said, "That's what I call fresh," which made me wonder if Celia knew anything about the birds and the bees. She was so shy about everything. My mother never told me about sex. When I got my period, she slapped my face and showed me how to wash the towels we had to use. You don't know how lucky you are in that department. I found out about what happened between men and women from a couple of girls in the schoolyard, and they had different versions. On our cot that night, Celia said, "At least you'll have more room when I go." "But I'll miss you," I said. She said we would see each other all the time. "Mr. Levine's apartment is only a few blocks from here." "You don't call him Herman?" She said she wasn't used to it yet. For 3 years she had known him as Mr. Levine. I didn't understand how it all happened so fast. I was only gone a week. Turns out it had started in May when Mrs. Kempinski, who lived downstairs, told my mother that Levine was looking for a wife. And Mama said, why didn't he look right in front of him? "He asked if he could walk me home after work," Celia said. "I met his sons a few times, and Jacob, the little one, seemed so sad. Levine asked if I would mind taking care of them and promised that I would have a good life with him." I asked if she was in love with him. "Not yet. Mama says you learn to love someone when you make a life together. She says a man who loves his children is a good man. Myron is 6 and Jacob is almost 4 and they need a mother. And like Mama says, I'm almost 30 years old and who knows if I'll ever get another chance like this. He'll take care of me and Mama and Papa when they get old." I could hear my mother's words coming out of her mouth, so I said, "Did she push you into this? You can still change your mind." She said no, that she had decided for herself. He asked me a month ago, and I told him I wanted to think. I didn't even tell Mama until you went away. When she found out where you were, she started screaming that the settlement ladies had sold you to be a white slave and wanted Papa to go to the police. But when I told her about me and Mr. Levine, she had more important things to think about. I had the horrible feeling that she'd said yes just to protect me. I even asked, "That's not why you're marrying him, is it?" She said no. "Actually, I feel bad because once I'm gone, you'll have to leave school, and I know how much you want to keep going." She was right. My parents didn't make enough money to pay the rent and everything else. Without Celia's pay, I was going to have to get a full-time job. I felt like a rock had fallen on my chest. Celia whispered, "I'm sorry, Addie." I said it wasn't her fault, which was true. I also said it was okay, but that was not true.